Welcome to the Investing Tutor Podcast, the show for professionals looking to master the most up-to-date strategies needed to build wealth and provide a stable financial future. Here's your host, Dr. Hans Boateng.
Hey friends, Dr. Hans here, the Investing Tutor, and friends, I have an incredible episode for you today. Joining us on today's podcast is Tiffany Aliche. She is the founder of The Budgetnista. She's an award-winning teacher of financial education and America's favorite personal financial educator. She's the author of her new book, Get Good With Money, a New York Times bestseller. Tiffany has created a financial movement that has helped over a million women worldwide completely transform the way that they think about their finances. She is also the creator of the Live Richer Academy. You all help me welcome Tiffany Aliche.
Thank you, Dr. Hans. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yes, an absolute pleasure. So, Tiffany, first and foremost, I just want to say congratulations on your new book. Congrats on just achieving the notable title as a New York Times bestseller. You know, when I started hearing or seeing on social media that you were about to release a book, that was one of the things that was on my heart. I was like, oh my gosh, I really want her to be a New York Times bestseller. And you've won two best-selling titles.
Yeah, it was so, I remember, Dr. Hans, when I posted it in the group that we're in, the financial group that we're in, that like, you know, I have a book coming out, and you said, you said, under the comment, oh, we have to get this to New York Times bestseller. And honestly, I laughed it off because I said, that's just not going to happen. I'm not going to have a New York Times bestseller. That's for someone else, not for me. And yeah, so it was an instant bestseller. It was number four on the how-to, wow, in the how-to category, which is the hardest category to chart in because it includes all kind of how-to books, including how to cook, you know, how to tell jokes. Everything is in that category. And it's the smallest category because most I think New York Times bestsellers list have more spots. And it was also number 10 on the business category. So on two New York Times bestsellers lists, not just for 1 week, but for 2 weeks running. And then we'll see if it makes it on this week as well. So it's just been so overwhelming. And then Wall Street Journal hit number one in the business category. And then I think like number four in another category, the USA Today list, Apple's list, Amazon's list. They have an indie list for indie bookstore sales. We hit over 10 bestsellers lists nationwide, and it's just been so overwhelming.
A huge, huge, huge congratulations. And for me, what I love about this book, Tiffany, to be completely transparent, is that your picture is on it. That was one of the core things that really spoke to me, you know, because just seldom do we have, you know, a Black woman dominating a male field and being able to step in and own that. So for me, when I saw it, I was just so, so happy and appreciative. But I am certain most of my audience know about you, but for the few that don't know your story, can you share, a brief, quick, high-level overview of how you got to where you are today, now as a New York Times bestseller?
Sure. I learned financial education at home from my parents, especially my father, who was in the finance field. I did well with my finances until about my mid-20s, until I got mixed up in a credit card scam. And then the recession happened. So it was just compounding. Because I lost my job, I lost my home, and I still had this credit card debt and student loan debt to pay. And as I was fixing myself, I started to help my friends, then friends of friends. So the Budgetnista was born. about 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago. And since then, it's just been growing. I've been serving largely women. We have some men, but it's mostly women that have been following my brand and my advice and my journey. And then about a year and some change ago, you know, I was asked to do a traditionally published book, because I've had self-published books before, like workbooks. And I said, okay, and was nervous about it, because it's a much bigger undertaking than, you know, to self-publish, because you only have to answer to yourself. And so I said yes. And I said yes largely because I noticed that people, my audience that I like to call dream catchers, they were succeeding, but only in individual subject matter. So only in credit, or only they were investing, but they weren't saving, or they were saving, but they weren't budgeting, or they're budgeting, but their credit was poor. And I thought, the teacher in me, because I used to be a school teacher before I started the Budgetista, thought, well, this is not a holistic way to look at your money. You should look at your money as more than individual subjects. And so I came up with a term called financial wholeness, which is when 10 core components of your financial life come together to create a strong foundation that the rest of your life can be built on. And I wrote a book about it, Get Good With Money. And now it's just been doing so well. I mean, I'm not going to lie, it surprised me. I know what I wrote, and I know that I put my heart and soul and everything into it, but you just don't know how it's going to be received. So,
and I'm sure when you were writing this book, the thought on your mind was that there are a ton of personal finance books out there. How are you looking to differentiate this particular book?
So how I wanted this book to be different is that, one, I wanted to make sure that it was no judgment, that it came from a place of kindness, but also from a place of a teacher. I have my master's in education, because sometimes I read a book and I think to myself, did they keep the student in mind, the reader? So the way that it's laid out and organized, there's homework in the book. I laid it out the way you would a lesson plan, because there's a specific way that human beings learn that I'm in tune to, because this is what I spent my 20s learning in school, about like working people through a specific learning pattern. So not only do they learn, but they're transformed. So I think that's what makes the book so different. And that's what's been the feedback. Like if you look at the reviews on like Amazon, the feedback is it's so easy to navigate and read, even though it's not a little book, but it didn't feel overwhelming. You walked me through, you gave me the steps. And so I think that I am uniquely qualified as a former teacher of 10 years, as someone with her master's in education, to really, and not only it's the what of the information, is the how you receive it. And so, and it's a fun book, honestly. Like I'm a little silly. I'm fun, you know, and it gives you that information. And probably most importantly is that just like I was as a preschool teacher, my job was to give you the fundamentals for the rest of your educational life as a preschool teacher. That's what I see my role as the Budgetista, to give you the financial fundamentals. So I am not teaching options or trading, and I'm not opposed to those things, but I want you to be able to do those things with a strong foundation. So that's what I give you, that strong foundation that you could do the other things and be successful at it.
Yeah, strong foundation is incredibly important. I wanted to pick those few words that you shared. You said you wanted to focus on no judgment and kindness. Why was this important? Or if I should say, why is this important to you?
It's important to me because so many people in the finance space, I found that in their effort to be helpful, that there's a lot of judgment there, as if they had not made mistakes themselves. And myself as a teacher, I did not find that it was judgment is not a good teacher. That yes, it might make you start to make changes, but it doesn't help you maintain those changes. And I feel like there's enough of that in the financial education space, and there needs to be empathy, because so many things are happening that are outside of our control. Quarantine, pandemic, none of us can control that. you know? But certainly, I like for us to be like, well, what can we do? And so I want you to be empowered to know that you might not be able to control everything, but certainly there are things that you can do to help mitigate some of the loss and to set yourself up to win. But I just don't believe that judgment has a place in education. And I was tired of seeing that as like the go-to for so many other financial educators.
Yeah, Tiffany, to your point, I started in this industry around 2016. That's when I, you know, created the Investing Tutor. And to your point, it really was a shaming industry, if you will, right? Yes. And finger pointing, like if you have debt, it's your fault. It's not that the U.S. has discriminatory practices, you know, with certain underrepresented groups. It's your fault. If, you know, if you cannot afford your bills, it's your fault. If you have student loans, it's your fault. And if you have student loans, don't do anything else with your finances until they are paid off.
Now, I've seen people literally say that they've waited to pay off their house before they've even invested for retirement. And I'm so, now that you're 50, well, now what will you do? And it's just very heartbreaking. Or people who, like, I think people think because I'm the budgetista that I'm like, I want you to over-sacrifice and just save everything. No. To me, savings is merely a tool to set you up to invest. That yes, that the there's two components to saving. Saving enough to have a little bit of a safety net. But beyond that, to oversave is to waste. You know, that I believe that you should be setting yourself up to invest for retirement and for wealth. And so I think that yes, that some of the, and maybe, you know, 20 years ago, some of these rules that came in the financial industry made sense, but they don't make sense now.
Yeah, they certainly do not. And I'm so happy and glad that the face of personal finance is changing and you are leading that charge. Tiffany, what inspired you to take on this challenge? And I call it a challenge because you literally stepped into this space. You're bringing empathy, kindness, humility, right? That is, that's missing in this space. And you're also bringing on other finance educators. You've done that with the Literature Academy. You did that in your book. So what inspired all of that, right? And also please speak to the notion or the intent to bring others along.
So I got into this industry because I just saw how much trouble I had. And I thought, this is too much to do by yourself. You ought not to. And I said, if I figure out how to dig my way out of this $300,000 plus in debt and all that comes along with it, that I'm going to show other people. Because at the end of the day, I'm a teacher. You know, like that is my goal and my role. I'm a teacher. And so as I was fixing myself, I saw so many other women needed help too. And so it just seemed like a natural progression from me teaching in the classroom to me teaching people outside of the classroom, because I've always wanted to live a life of service. And so, but what is also important to me too, is that I help other people who are also doing the work, share their voice as well. Like inside Get Good With Money, my book, I share other financial educators on purpose because I want to teach my audience that there's no way that one person knows everything. Like recently I got, rotator cuff surgery on my shoulder because I tore a ligament, and I have a general practitioner doctor. But Dr. Ibigwe did not do my shoulder. That's not her specialty. She sent me to an orthopedic surgeon that this is like, and especially one in particular, that specialty was not just bones, but also rotator cuffs, you know? And so we do that in medicine, but why not in finance? One person to be the guru of all gurus? How? So that person is an attorney for estate planning. That person is a tax accountant. So he's a CPA as well. That person is also a credit specialist. This person also is knows all thing about investing. Oh, and also, so I wanted to teach my audience that I don't believe in the financial guru. I believe in what I call the financial girlfriend. So I'm here to show you what I know. I like to think of myself as the general practitioner. I know a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but then I will point you in the direction of someone that is their specialty. And I want us to get very used to and accustomed to that way of thinking when we're looking for educational help as it relates to our money. Because when you do that, you practice discernment. So when someone says something and you're like, that's not right, you can hear it better. So when a financial guru tells you, don't invest for retirement until you've paid off every single one of your debts, you know that doesn't make sense because you follow Dr. Hans and you're like, okay, this is my specialist when it comes to investing. That doesn't make sense. Dr. Hans, this is all he does. So who would know better? You know what I mean? And so I think that part is equally as important to create space that other financial educators can be seen and heard, but also to teach the audience how I believe people should approach financial education.
Such a phenomenal response. Tiffany, this thought came to mind. How are you able to identify individuals that you can trust and bring along? And has anyone, and I'm not telling you to, you know, name names, has anyone disappointed you along the way? And how did you deal with that? Because, right, you're putting your brand and your name behind, you know, these individuals that you showcase to the world. So how are you balancing that?
So many of the people that I showcase, well, to start in the book, the people that I showcase are the people that I have personally trusted with my personal financial journey. So my attorney, Toni Moore, she is the expert for the estate planning chapter. Toni does my estate plan. So who better to trust than the person that I've trusted with my literal afterlife, you know? The credit Nativa Heard inside the book, she... like when my credit was totally, when I first started on my credit journey, I've known Nativa for almost 10 years now. For people that I really give full access, it was the people that have helped me on my journey. And then as I've begun to expand, I literally watch as many people as possible in the financial space to see how they show up, how they navigate with their audience, what their audience says about them. And so I'm, you know, it's not somebody who I'll see one week and say, okay, I might watch you for 2 or 3 years and I might reach out and then I might give you a chance, something small, like I'm doing a live. Would you like to do one with me? Let's see, you know? And so that's usually what it is that I start with the people that have helped me. Then I get sometimes recommendations from those people who I trust. And then I watch and I look at how they navigate and how, because I'm looking for a servant's heart, not just for a financial mind. Like, do you actually serve your community or are you just looking to make money from them? Which is fine, but that's not what I'm looking for to partner. Because if I'm going to share my audience with you, I want them to get the same experience that I would give them if I were the expert in your expertise. Someone who's going to really serve them from a place of kindness, from a place of empathy, you know, from a place of no judgment. And I just think that's important. Not to say people can't make money, because I do. I mean, we made our first 8 figures, over $10 million last year. So money can be made. You can help good people. You can do good work and you can make good money. So I'm not opposed to that, but I want to make sure that in the way that it's being done, that it honors the very people that you have promised to serve.
With your book, what surprised you about just the journey of launching and putting it out there? What surprised you the most besides the, you know, all of the bestseller accomplishments?
Probably the thing that surprised me the most was just how hard the marketing would be. So the book was very hard to write. So that, like, just that alone was a lot. But I just didn't realize, like, whew, it was going to be so much. I mean, I'm very accustomed to marketing, but it was it's different. Marketing a book versus, say, like my online school or even my own podcast, Brown Ambition, you know, it's different. And so I just didn't anticipate how heavy the marketing lift would be and still be. And so that surprised me a lot. It took almost my whole team to work collectively together to get the word out.
Looking at the contents of your book, I noticed, you know, each chapter is essentially adding up to 100%, right? Mm-hmm. It starts with 10%, then goes to 20%. What was the thought process that in reaching 100%, a person is becoming whole?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about even how you thought about laying out how you were writing the book, specifically with regards to the contents? Like, for example, let's say, you know, budget building, you know, saving like a squirrel. So what was the thought process in laying it out?
I thought to myself, what are the components? Because I had reached financial freedom, meaning that if I didn't want to work anymore, I don't have to. I have enough money and I generate enough via investments, like investments in the market, but also I have real estate and I have businesses that I can step down and have a CEO take over and still make money there. So I'd reached financial freedom, but I was still a mess financially. And I thought, wait, everybody's been telling me you reach financial freedom. That's it. And that's just, it just wasn't true. And then I started to look like, for example, people like Prince, the artist formerly known as, we all know Prince was financially free. He owned the masters to his music. He was very wealthy. When he passed away, he did not have an estate plan. He was actually texting his friends to say, please make sure this money goes here. Please make sure this money goes there. Can you imagine? That's not an estate plan. That's not going to hold up in court. And it didn't. All of his money ended up going to his sister. Now, here's the thing. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But one, I can only imagine the taxes she paid because he didn't have a trust. Two, Prince gave a lot of money to music programs because music was very important to him. So he gave a lot of money to nonprofits that supported music for kids. What if his sister decides not to do that? It's her prerogative now. It's her money. So what if he wanted that to continue, but because he didn't have a will or a trust in place, it won't if she doesn't want it to. So I say all that to say, I thought to myself, you've reached financial freedom. It's not enough though. So it made me think, well, what is missing? And I started to make a list of the things that I'd done and a list of the things that were still not done. And for me, I didn't have enough insurance. I didn't have my financial professionals in place and I didn't have an estate plan. But I started to list everything I thought was really the foundation of getting good with your money. And as I listed budget, savings, debt, credit, learning to earn, investing, insurance, net worth, your financial team and estate planning. I said, okay, this is the foundation. It's not everything exhaustively, but this is the core foundation that the rest of your financial life can be built on. And I realized these are 10 things. You know what? What if I weighted them and said, okay, each of these things is 10% and you collect 10% along the way. So you can clearly see, okay, right now I'm at 70%. So once I get my, which I've since now done, once I get my insurance to a place that makes sense for where I am now, now you're at 80%. I know people like to see how close or how far they are from where they want to be. And so that's when it came to me. When I made the list of like the foundational steps, I realized there were 10 steps and I gave them each 10% because people like to see how long it takes before they get whole. And then that's where the name financial wholeness came from. And so it just has been, you know, it just has worked together so perfectly because people are like, okay, like even now for those listening, I have a financial wholeness quiz. It's at GGWM for Get Good With Money, GGWMquiz.com. You can take it. It takes like a minute or so, and it will tell you instantly what percentage of financial wholeness you've already reached. 20%, 30%, 100%. That's so awesome. Because what that allows you to do is see where do you stand, and then I email you a checklist so you can get clear about what you still need to do. So I just share all that to say that, Dr. Hans, is that, you know, like I think it was a mixture of really like my teacher's brain of how students need to figure out what do I need to do to get 100% in this class. And then my financial educator brain thinking about for myself, what were those steps that I needed to accomplish to be financially whole? Because you can be financially whole and not financially free and still live a very good life with your money.
For everyone who's tuned in, we are discussing Tiffany Alice's book, Get Good With Money. And for the next couple of minutes, I'm going to dive in to have us discuss a few things from the book But I highly, highly recommend everyone who's listening, wherever books are sold, get good with money. I cannot recommend it enough. Tiffany, there's this chapter which is focused on picking your money team. Mm-hmm. It really stood out to me because some of the smartest individuals out there, right? We go back like the Henry Fords, the Rockefellers. They surrounded themselves with some of the smartest people. So when I saw that, like picking your money team, I was like, that is brilliant. Can you please speak to us about what that money team component involves, the different types of individuals, and also how did you come up with that idea?
So I came up with the idea for money team when I lost all that money to that scam from who was supposed to be my friend when I was in my 20s. And I realized then that I had someone on my money team. I didn't tap into them. My father has his bachelor's in economics and his master's in finance and was an avid investor. So why was I investing with a friend when I had someone on my team already? And it was kind of the first time that I realized that if you want to go, there's an African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with others. And it was kind of like the first lesson that you will make less mistakes if you lean into other people who this is what they do. And just over time, I realized there's no way I could learn all of the things like insurance. Yes, I can have some basic insurance knowledge, but as I got older, I run more than one multimillion-dollar business, and the insurance is different. You know, I have more than one property. Insurance looks different. I don't have time to learn how to be an insurance agent. I have to lean into someone that's all they do, so they can walk me through what type of business insurance do I need, how much is appropriate, you know, what it would look like if something were to happen to me. Does the company need insurance on me? These are things that made me realize, okay. Also, too, you know, maybe in my 20s and my early 30s, I didn't necessarily need an accountant, you know, but now I do because my taxes are way more complicated. You know, also, too, you might not need a certified financial planner if you're young and a lot of things you can do yourself. But let's just say you have a child that has special needs and will always need to be looked after. You might want to lean into a planner to plan out what your financials are going to look like. You know, not everything is DIY. You know, sometimes you really have to lean into the expertise of other people depending on your life and who you are and how you are. For me, an attorney is part of my financial team, because I needed someone to do my estate plan. I need a trust. You know, once you get past more than $500,000 worth of assets to put into a trust, you should absolutely have a trust, or else your family is going to be looking at a hefty tax bill because you did not plan. And so these are some of my team members. And at the very least, I tell people, you might not have an accountant, you might not have an attorney, you might not have a certified financial planner or an insurance agent, but everyone should have an accountability partner on their money team. That is just someone who you trust that you can share your journey with. They don't have to be a financial expert or educator. Just, it could be your mom, your friend, your sister, your favorite person at work, but you check in with each other as you work toward your money goals and they're working toward their money goals. An accountability partner is someone everyone can have.
Tiffany, there's a chapter in your book, which once again, I just want to acknowledge you for writing. It is insurance, specifically life insurance. In the Black community, often life insurance, specifically permanent life insurance, is, and I'm not saying this is only happening in the Black community. I just want to, you know, share that as a disclaimer, but I just see it quite often, maybe because that's the community I'm in. But there's this, this rhetoric that permanent life policies are wealth building investment tools, and mm-hmm. that they have these tax strategies and that people can build cash value and all of these things. And you went straight to the core and just dropped the facts. So I don't want to give away the facts that you shared, but please, can you share with my audience the core of what you shared about, you know, life insurance, specifically permanent versus term?
So I shared that life insurance, like any other insurance, is a risk management tool, not an investment. Here's why. So the life insurance company has amazing marketing skills, because when you have car insurance, you don't think, I have to have an investment with my car insurance. You have pet insurance, you don't think, I should have an investment with my pet insurance. Homeowners insurance, every other insurance, you understand and acknowledge, this is a risk management tool. This is a, if something should happen, I've got it covered. That's what I mean by risk management tool. You're not mad when you don't use your pet insurance because you're glad that your dog is alive. You're not mad when you don't use your car insurance because you're glad that you didn't get into a car accident. So why is it with life insurance, if you don't use it, somehow you're mad that you're not dead? It doesn't make sense, but you want to know why? Because life insurance companies have done such a great job in twisting people's minds to believe that life insurance should be an investment. It's not. It's an investment for them. So you, the difference between whole life, so whole life insurance is a policy where you keep paying indefinitely. It doesn't, there's no term. There's no like 20 years, 30 years, you know. Term is literally just that. You pay, but it might be 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, you know. Because really life insurance, the purpose of real life insurance is to cover you during your income earning years. That's what it's for. It's not supposed to go on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. It's for, okay, it's like car insurance. If you no longer have a car, you don't need car insurance.
Yes.
Your pet is no longer here. What, are you still paying pet insurance? Your pet is no longer here? No. So that's the way. And I know a lot of insurance agents were so angry at me. This is why I made sure. Remember I said it's so important that you don't lean on just your own understanding. So for that particular chapter, I leaned into a certified financial planner who has been doing it for a number of years. Life insurance is one of the things she leans into. She's my certified financial planner. So it wasn't just me saying, this is what I believe. So anyway, I we went back and forth and I said, well, is permanent life insurance ever good for anyone? She said, if you are somebody like Beyonce who has exhausted every other type of investment, I mean, you have put money and stuffed it in every corner and crevice of your life, then maybe this less than 1% of person, maybe this 0.25%, it might make sense because she has exhausted every other avenue. Are you Beyonce? Are you Oprah? Okay. Most of us are not. So you don't need it. And so like an example is a healthy, say 30-year-old woman with $1 million whole life policy, this quote unquote investment policy, she's looking to pay about $740. That same woman with a term policy, a 30-year term policy, is looking to pay $40. So from $740 to $40, that's a $700 difference. Do you know how much money you can make if you invested $700 a month? And the math has been done, and I put it in the book, that on average, they found the return on that whole life policy, you're looking under 2%. You might as well put your money in a savings account. That's the investment, you know? And so like, and the problem is 60% of people don't finish paying their life insurance policy. That means most people can't continue to keep paying that $700 a month because it's too much. During the last recession, I have a term policy still to this day. I got it in my late 20s, a $300,000 policy, because I bought a house for $220,000. And so I was like, if something should happen, I put my parents and my sisters on it. I want them to be able to pay off the house. My policy was $21 a month. Now imagine if I would have had a whole life policy. Maybe it would have been $200 or $300. Then the recession happens, I lose my job. I could still afford my $21 versus if I would have had a whole life policy, I would have had to default on that and lost all that money I put in. I still have that $21 policy a month now. And so that's what I share in that. And like, I know a lot of agents will probably be upset because they get very wealthy off of those whole life policies that you don't need. That's so much wealth leaving your family that you can use to invest and actually make money off. Investments are investments. Insurance are risk management tools.
Tiffany, I've been saying this for close to 5 years, you know, and just to open up your book to that chapter, specifically when I saw insurance, I was like, okay, can I just see what Tiffany is going to share? And you literally, just word for word, shared exactly what I've been trying to say for almost 5 years. And once again, I acknowledge you for stepping into what would be a very, very uncomfortable just state, because to your point, there are many insurance agents who will not be happy with that conversation. And you did just such a great job.
Yeah. And some of them have written me there, you know, written me angry. I said, well, it speaks volumes about who you're here to truly serve. I don't care about insurance agents getting upset with me, you know, because I'm not in service to you. I'm in service to my audience so they can live truly a richer life. And so, you know, I mean, it's not, and even in it too, because I know some people say, well, my agent said this. There's literally a back and forth script. If your agent says this, this is what they're saying. If your agent said that, this is what it really means. Because I want you to be like, oh, wow, got it, you know?
And I, to your point about the $21 covering you for $300,000, you know, Tiffany, I've shared this personally and I don't share it a lot, but whenever I get an opportunity, I share it. I pay personally. Now I have two policies actually, about roughly $55. Mm-hmm. And it's covering me for $1 million. Mm-hmm. So I have two of those. So then, you know, we're looking at 2 million. And it's costing me just what, $110. It is absolutely crazy. And the truth is, if God forbid something is to happen to me, right, that policy is going to pay out just like a whole life policy mm-hmm. will. And I don't think people even grasp that concept. You know, look at you sharing $21 to get $300,000. Often, as minorities, as immigrants, we kind of default to, you know, soliciting funds from friends and family mm-hmm. if something bad happens. But $21, I know, and I can say with certainty that if people in our community were educated about the right type of insurance policy, any and everyone can make a choice to pay that $20, or even if it's $25 for 300K or 250K, you know, sometimes even close to $400,000 policy. And that amount of money is mm-hmm. extremely life-changing. So thank you. I mean, you've written an amazing book.
Thank you.
For that part, I just want to just send you so many compliments. Now, I wanted to talk about just a minor detail in the book, the assets versus liabilities column. I can understand why student loans, you know, was placed in the liabilities column, because you have some individuals that might go to college, not know what degree they are going for. They are just going because someone told them go to college, right? But for individuals who end up utilizing that student loan as a way to be able to get a degree, right, which the degree becomes an asset for them and then throws off income. Isn't it possible that we can look at a student loan as an asset?
I think we can look at student loans the way we look at potentially, like the way we look at a mortgage or a house, right? Mm. That it's in both columns, potentially, meaning that the cost of the house, the mortgage, is a liability, but that the value of the house is an asset. So what you end up with is really the equity. But it's very hard with student loans to figure out what the value is going to be. Like the cost of the student loan, because, and especially now more than ever, people are, I don't know that a student loans are yielding people something that is viable in this market days and time. You know what I mean? Like, so, I mean, I could see what you mean.
Internet. So And to clarify, like I'm thinking about it from the standpoint that, like when you look at most of their stats, right, and I'm sure you've looked at them, most minorities, education is what pushes us to be, you know, extremely competitive. And for most of us, we might not have like a 529 from like parents that we can leverage. So often, student loan is the way that we are able to acquire that degree. So to your point about looking at the value of the education, for someone who, let's say, has the knowledge, has the skills, has the ability, and perhaps they can, you know, pursue becoming a doctor or an engineer, right, or a lawyer, and actually getting a job at the end of that, you know, degree, it's at that point. And I completely understand it. It is at that point that an individual has translated, right, something which was a liability into an income generating asset. But until a person actually gets the job, I totally understand that that student loan is a liability.
And especially because in our community, unfortunately, we tend to have, on average, way more student loan debt than our other counterparts, but about $50,000 more than the average non-Black student, white student to be specific. So meaning that you will have gotten, I could be, let's just say, I don't know, I went to school to be an engineer. You are an engineer. I'm an engineer. I owe $50,000 to $100,000 more than you. So although we are both qualified now for the same job, but then the likelihood is I'm going to be paid less than you. This is why student loans can be very tricky. So I can see what you're saying, but there's also, unfortunately, there the statistics show that Black students tend to take out way more debt than their white counterparts and are left with this debt that, quite honestly, oftentimes is not able to be paid back in a reasonable time. That will, not to say, I mean, I think going to college is still a viable place. It's just, if you have to pay with it student loan debt, I honestly don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that conundrum, because student loan debt, school valuable, this debt, I mean, you could be, there are people who are still 50 paying off student loan debts. How is that freedom? You know, do I think you should go to school? But I think people have to be very mindful about how they pay for it.
Yeah, I think the mindful component is really important. And for me, I just always stress that people should do their due diligence, right? Make sure that you're pursuing a career that has viable job opportunities, so that at graduation, an individual knows there's a high likelihood they're going to be employed. They are going to be making a decent amount of income, and all of a sudden they can then convert that liability into an asset, mm-hmm. right? Because let's say, for example, pharmacist, which is the degree that I went for, you know, on average, PharmD might cost, we're factoring in student loans, maybe $100,000 to $150,000, right? Now, if that individual graduates and then they get a job, all of a sudden now they are earning on average about $125,000 in income, right? So assuming they have their job, then all of a sudden now they can then, you know, repay that liability, which is their student loan. But if a person graduates and doesn't get a job, all of a sudden it just becomes all of what you are describing. It's how I viewed it, because what's the alternative for someone who wants to go to pharmacy school who doesn't have, you know, $100,000 to $150,000 for their tuition? What do they do? You know, some financial so-called gurus would say, go and work a minimum wage job to save up for for school, which further is going to stifle our progress, right? Meanwhile, someone of a different race who had a 529, that person is in. They had college paid off. They are working. they're off, they go. Meanwhile, we should what? Go work a minimum wage job and take what? 5 to 7 years before we come back and pay. To your point, it's not a straightforward answer, but we need to think about some solutions. And I know this administration, and you spoke with them, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you spoke with the Biden administration. I believe this administration needs to look at this very closely. How do we solve this? And also to your point, and I think this is what you're trying to imply, correct me if I'm wrong, in a technological world where we have access to laptops and smartphones, why are we still paying $100,000 to $150,000 for school? Right? Why doesn't that cost come down so that it's more affordable and individuals don't have to take on that much debt?
Because also too, sometimes too, many of the professions that Black students are steered into make the money that you borrowed almost impossible to pay back. Mm. That's something to be very mindful of too, that you know, if you borrow $100,000 to become a middle school teacher, so it's going to be, you see what I mean? You have to be mindful that you actually are making your school loans an investment. Will I get this money back? I remember I didn't understand, but my father, I wanted to go into sociology or something like that. And he was like, that's fine. But then you have to pay for it differently because you're not likely to make that money back, you know? And I said, okay. So then I looked into other things and then I decided to get my degree in business because I knew with what I'd borrowed, it's more likely that I'd be able to get my money back. So.
Tiffany, what would you say your purpose is on this earth?
To me, my purpose is clear. It is to teach. To teach with the result of helping people transform their lives and make it better.
Wow. Yeah, you're right. It's crystal clear to you. Mm-hmm. Looking at your journey, you know, going from middle school teacher, you know, at some point you started your business, you earned 6 figures, then you went to 7 figures, and then you went to 8 figures, right? This quote from Jim Rohn has always stayed with me. The quote is, success is what you attract by who you become, right? So who did you need to become to go from 6 figures to 7 figures? And then from 7 figures to 8 figures. Can you walk us through? Or you can even start from like the middle school teacher, right? Then go into 6 figures and 6 to 7, 7 to 8.
I had to become a leader. Well, one, at first I had to become a teacher. That was the first step, you know? So I had to learn to teach. And then I had to learn to serve, you know? So I taught in a low socioeconomic neighborhood. So that's through that I learned service. Then I had to learn to become self-motivated, to create my own business and to navigate by myself without telling me you have to be here at this time and you have to do this at this time, right? Then starting my business, I really had to learn you can't do it all on your own. So I had to learn to lead by building a team. And then I stayed there for a while. And most recently, I had to learn to ask for help because I was doing everything myself and working so hard. I had reached a capacity where I could no longer put in any more work. So I had to learn to ask for help. How do I continue to get the level of excellence done that I've been able to without having to do every single thing myself? So I had to learn to ask for help. And so I have all these coaches now that have really helped me to look and to think and to navigate differently. And now too, I also had to learn to dream because I have accomplished everything I've ever dreamed of plus some. From my earnings goals to my, you know, goals for the book to my goals for my business, everything plus some. And so now I'm learning to dream bigger dreams. I didn't realize wow, I'm just now 41. So if I've accomplished everything, maybe I dream too small. And so teaching, learning, leadership, growth, asking for help, dreaming, all of these things were are critical components along the journey. But the key is to acknowledge that you are on the journey and to know that you're going from place to place to place and not to get stuck.
Wow. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. Tiffany, for individuals who want to connect with you, where can they go to find you?
Well, I am The Budgetnista on every platform, at The Budgetnista on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok even though I don't TikTok much, Facebook, YouTube. And if you are wanting to get my book, Get Good With Money, 10 Simple Steps to Becoming Financially Whole, you can find that at getgoodwithmoney.com.
Tiffany, it's fascinating that your book is about 10 steps to get financially whole, because I wanted to do something special for the audience. I wanted to give away 10 books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, today. So for everyone listening, what I'm going to do is I'm going to place a list of 10 questions in my Instagram feed, and you can pick any of the 10 to respond to, but it's one person per question. And the first 10 people who answer those questions will get a free copy of Tiffany's book, Get Good With Money. And for everyone listening, I mean, I know I'm doing this giveaway, but please do me a favor. Go to Amazon, go to Barnes and Nobles, wherever you can find this book, and please get a copy of this book. First, the reason why I want you to do so is because we are supporting Tiffany, right? She has done something which is not common, okay? And she has excelled at it. So you're purchasing this book, right? If you follow my platform, it's a way of supporting what she's done, right? Also, the reason why I want you to get this book is because I went through the book, specifically the chapters that I'm extremely passionate about. And I was extremely impressed. Even the investing chapter, you know, you think that, oh, maybe there might be a few things which are missing and things of that nature, but oh my gosh, very well written. So I feel like this is a generational wealth and legacy type book where you can, one, buy it for yourself to learn, but then pass it along to others that you want to give them the gift of generational wealth, right? You're essentially saying, hey, here, get good with money. Let's support Tiffany. And also, Tiffany, thank you so much for stepping into your calling to do what you do. It's just absolutely fascinating and inspiring to watch.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Really is. So thank you so much for joining us on today's podcast episode. It's been absolutely phenomenal.
Thank you. This has been awesome. I can't wait to continue to connect with your audience. And you know, Dr. Hans, you have been following you for some time now. So I love the work that you're doing. I feel like you are the next step. When people finish getting good with their money, it's like, okay, now you are ready to invest at the next level. So thank you for doing what you do.